911, what's your emergency?
Oh!
I think that was good. I think that was good.
It was great. It was perfect.
I was feeling very like Scott McCall in like season one, episode six of Teen Wolf when they're trapped in the school.
Of course. Well, my problem with the howling on Teen Wolf was always like in season three when they have to get Styles out of the upside down or whatever.
Oh my God. He is. Yeah.
And they're He's like, you go. Have to howl to signal to your pack. And he just like yells.
Yeah.
Like it's not, it doesn't really sound like a howl.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All the howling was just like roars.
Oh, Teen Wolf.
They didn't know what howling was. Because it was sexier to roar, but they had to call it a howl.
Yeah, exactly. I think they knew what it was, but they were like too embarrassed to go all out with like the campy old werewolf type howl.
Yeah, it's like, is the show called Teen Lion? Is the show called
Teen
Lion? Is the
show called Teen Boy Who Yells Really Loud? It might as well have been.
I mean, like, we kind of knew that it was washed the minute they did the werewolf transformation and didn't even give him any actual fur.
Oh my God. The werewolf transformation on that show was so half-assed.
It was just half-assed.
What if we gave you a slightly heavy brow and some sideburns, literally?
I think I said in my video that it was a cross between a Hylian, like from Zelda, and Spike from Buffy. Like,
yeah, like there's been a lot of media. I feel like the like brow to nose, whatever that prosthetic is called, it must have just been like one of the earliest and like most popular types of like latex prosthetic, because I feel like there are so many like genre shows and movies that use kind of a similar face thing. Like, I feel like there's a Star Trek creature that does that kind of thing.
Oh, the like the Klingon.
Yeah, they kind of have that look.
Yeah, no, definitely. It's honestly, it's probably cheap too, and so it's just like, oh, you need to make a boy look monstrous. Give him the nose thing. Give him the nose. Give him the snout, the schnoz. It is fitting that, you know, because the sun sets so early now that we talk about the full moon episode of 911. While the moon is already out. It's out for me. Is it out for you?
I don't think so, but also it's cloudy because like I said to you before we started recording, it has been snowing in St. Paul, Minnesota all day. So the sky is just like white right now.
I'm so fucking jealous of you right now, by the way. I love
snow.
Don't
be, because it's like 30 degrees out.
No, that's amazing. I love snow so much. I love the cold weather. I love especially cold weather, no wind, and you can just go outside and just like hear no sounds.
I actually also love snow.
You know?
Yeah, I actually also love snow, but I don't love the cold.
How is the skiing in Minnesota? I know we're not really doing introductions anymore, because like, if you don't know us, you ought to. Do you want to just dive into the episode?
Well, sure, Ryan. Today we are covering season one, episode seven, Full Moon in parentheses, Creepy AF. And the first thing I need to say... The first thing I need to say is that I realized when I watched the episode today, I had like fully Mandela affected the title of this episode, because I was 100% certain that the title of this episode was Full Moon in parentheses hashtag creepy AF. I don't know why I believed this, but I was certain that that was the title. I like opened up Hulu. I'm like, huh, they didn't include the hashtag. And I like looked on the Wikipedia. I'm like, oh, they also didn't include the hashtag. So I like looked on the IMDb and there's no hashtag. And at this point, it's like, okay, maybe I was wrong. Maybe there is no hashtag. But now I'm like, why did I think that? I even like looked through all the other episodes of the show to see like, is there a different episode with a hashtag in the title? And I like got them mixed up, but I don't think there is.
Do you think this could be Degrassi brain poisoning?
Oh God, because every episode of Next Class started with a hashtag.
Yeah.
Oh, that show is so terrible on so many levels. I guess it could be that, but I don't know. I really thought, I like had a joke ready to go and everything. I was going to be like, Ryan, like, what do you think made them think it was a good idea to put a hashtag in their episode title? And now I'm realizing nothing, because they didn't do that.
Because they didn't.
And that was just like, that was just my hallucinations.
You're like slanderous lies about this episode you told yourself in your head over and over, and then you go into it and you're just like, oh, maybe
I'm so
I was
sorry
wrong.
I would like to issue a formal apology to Ryan Murphy Brad Falchuk and Tim Minear. I don't know what I was thinking.
Well, you know what? I'm glad someone's apologizing to Ryan Murphy. I'm glad finally the time is this man. We've been waiting for it. All he does is give.
Not even remotely true.
I know.
I wonder if maybe I was thinking of the fact that it's AF, like it has AF in the title, which is like a different sort of dated, you know, slangism.
Is it dated? I'm still saying that. I'm going to be honest.
People still say that, I guess. I guess it just strikes me as a little bit like, I don't know. It could be dated. Maybe this is cope. I just am trying to cover my embarrassing mistake.
No, I get you. I mean, it is cringe when they do it. You know what I mean? Like, because they're not tweeting. They're titling an episode. You know, they're
right. And it's also the way it was like all caps AF instead of, you know, nowadays I think people use it a little more casually with the lowercase AF.
Yeah.
Well, it's like corporate. It's like a corporate thing, like a TV show title trying to use slang would do that.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to say, it also just feels kind of try hard because it's like, why couldn't the episode just have been called Full Moon? Like, who decided to add the little aside saying creepy AF?
I'm really
hoping.
Like,
you can just make...
I'm really
hoping.
You can
just make the episode.
That it was Tim. AF. I'm really hoping it was Tim, like, approving the scripts. Mm-hmm. And he was like, Full Moon, ooh, that feels creepy AF.
Oh, you make sure to put that in the title. He's like, nobody's going to know the episode is creepy AF unless we tell them.
Yeah.
We couldn't possibly just write the episode to be creepy. We need to also make it explicit in the title before you even start the episode.
Because you know what they say, show and tell.
I guess I will say, as to the creepy AF element of the episode, I'm kind of interested in the concept of this episode because it's not a Halloween episode, right?
No.
Like, it aired probably in, what, like, March or something.
Yeah, yeah, because it was, like, this show was, like, a mid-season replacement or something.
Yeah, and so it's not a Halloween episode, and it's not, like, an outright, like, scary episode. It's just kind of, like, an episode where it's almost like the theme is that everything is, like, a little bit amiss.
Yeah.
And I find that kind of interesting.
I mean, there are just straight-up horror elements in this episode in particular. I mean, like, we've dabbled in
horror
before.
There are also genuinely creepy AF moments.
There are, but we've dabbled in horror before, especially with the Valentine's Day episode with Melora and her little Buffalo Bill house. But this is the first one where, like, not only is there horror, there's like a moment of gore, like light gore, like it feels kind of out of left field on some levels because it's like it still has that classic 911 tone where 85% of the time it's a sitcom, and at the same time it's like dipping its toes into new waters. I don't know, it's like you could totally tell they wanted to make a Halloween episode, you know,
yeah,
to like have
yeah,
an
that's
excuse
always the vibe
for
I get.
Yeah,
it's like their Summerween episode.
Yeah, it's their Summerween episode. But honestly, I feel like they have a built-in excuse in that the show does take place in LA and weird shit goes down in LA, so so they can
and supposedly even on the full moon. I mean, the whole concept of this episode is like supposedly in these professions, like, things get crazier around the full moon, so it's just a crazy full moon kind of night.
Before we dive into the episode, I just wanted to ask, have you heard of this phenomenon, this like people get weird and crazy during the full moon? Have you heard of it outside of werewolf lore?
I feel like maybe I've heard of, like, oh, some people's, like, moods might shift around the full moon. I don't know that I had heard of, like, this being, like, a mass phenomenon.
Yeah. I've tried to research this in the past, and I think there is truth to, like, what Abby says in the episode, and we'll get into it. But I don't think there is a rise in violent crime rates on, like, the night of the full moon, right? Like,
right.
I don't think that's a statistical trend. Yeah, yeah, I just looked it up. The incidence of crimes on equinox and solstice days did not differ significantly. But then also, in the instances where I've spoken to firefighters or cops or whatever through, like, school things, like, sometimes they'd bring in someone for, like, an EMT class or something like that, just to, like, give a talk to a class. Like, I feel like I have heard anecdotally that, like, yeah, it's a real thing.
Yeah, well, I wanted to say at one point, I think it's it's almost like a superstition, right? And yeah. more than it is a real thing. And it's interesting that this is the show's first brush with the idea of superstition, which will turn out to be kind of a big recurring theme on this show. Like, they often will bring up sort of firefighter and first responder, like, folk superstitions.
Yeah, which I guess is just, like, I guess, like, a product of them exploring the culture of these institutions and, like, how they sort of have their own folklore and everything. I was just jazzed about it because, like, I love that shit. And so I'm so excited to talk about this episode.
Yeah, I love how we haven't said a single thing about what actually happens.
I know. You tried and I derailed us right off the bat.
Okay, let's go. So okay, we open with kind of a weird moment for 911. We kind of touched on this in the last episode that it's not that common for this show to do voiceover.
Mm-hmm.
But when they do, it's usually like this, where we open with Hen is like sitting on the beach looking at the full moon, and she's giving this voiceover about how the full moon makes everybody crazy.
Mm-hmm.
It's very like kind of a somber and foreboding tone.
Yeah, but she opens with a history lesson, which is interesting. She opens with like 4.5 million years ago or something, a big asteroid collided with Earth, and then the dust particles that were trapped in the atmosphere formed into the moon. She's like, honestly, the story of why people go crazy in the full moon goes back like millions of years, and I'm going to tell you all about it.
But that's so in character for Hen, because she loves to just like have random knowledge about stuff.
She does.
Which I love.
I know. It's consistent. It's cute. We go from those Teen Wolf vibes to a little bit of domesticity with Karen and Hen at home. Hen is trying to go to bed because the night of the full moon is up next. And of course, she is very superstitious.
Yeah, she needs her rest.
Writing's
but
on
Karen,
the wall. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sorry.
Karen is desperately trying to get her wife to have sex with her.
Yes.
And you're kind of like, Hen, Tracy Toms is in your bed right now, and you're just like completely blowing her off, but whatever. It's kind of an interesting scene.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of an interesting scene where like Karen explicitly brings up the idea of lesbian bed death.
Yep.
And she's like, she like defines it like as if mm-hmm. Hen doesn't know what she's talking about. And she's like, you know, I've been in relationships before that are more like a sisterhood. And she says, like, if we're not having sex, then what makes us a couple? Which is kind of a crazy thing to say. although the episode doesn't really invalidate that idea, which is kind of unfortunate.
Yeah.
But
how does this feel for you as our resident lesbian in chief?
Well, I did look up the episode and find that it was written by a man.
Right.
So, you know, I'm sure he meant well, mm-hmm. but it was written by a guy named Adam Penn, who this is the only episode of 911 he ever wrote. He primarily had written before this Mr. Robot, like episodes of Mr. Robot.
The Rami Malek show?
Which was interesting to me because I was like, well, that's like a very different type of show and type of tone than 911,
uh-huh.
But a good show.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I was interested in that, which maybe that explains part of why this episode is so kind of like, you know, like creepy and dark in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really have much of a critique against this part of the episode. I do have sort of a critique against the depiction of Hen and Karen on the show at large, which I almost included a line about this in my video, but I decided to cut it out. I don't know. I didn't want people to take it the wrong way. Basically, I feel like Hen and Karen are the only couple on this show who are like never allowed to express intimacy.
Oh.
And it's interesting that this is like one of their first moments on the show, brings it up as an idea, and then the show like never rectifies that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm not saying like I need them to be like having sex all the time. And I think part of the reason I cut it out of my video is I didn't want people to think I was saying like lesbians and media need to be like super sexualized or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just like, you know, we see that other couples have sex with each other.
Yeah.
So I just wrote in my notes, let Hen Ren fuck.
Right.
And I kind of stand by that. If you watch the show, there are a lot of moments, like a surprising amount of moments, where you see Hen and Karen like trying to start having sex or like about to, and then they like get interrupted like that only ever happens to them.
Yeah.
And like there's like one sequence in the entire show, I think it's in their backstory episode in season six, that even hints at them like being a sexual relationship. And it's not that I like need them to be like that, but it just feels like kind of a double standard that they're the only ones who are kind of depicted as this very like chaste, like unsexy couple.
Yeah. I guess getting into the heads of the writers, how maybe they would rationalize it to themselves is that, you know, Hen and Karen are established, they're married, they've been together for a long time, maybe there isn't a lot of erotic excitement in their lives, which is of course part of the conflict of this season for them, but I'm just thinking, like, you know, once the season ends and that conflict is resolved, why wouldn't they get a little sexier?
It's like a couple male writers like learned that term and then were like, oh, I gotta write this into my lesbian relationship.
It's like a self-fulfilling prophecy, you know? It's like the show's telling on itself, but it doesn't actually want to fix it.
Yeah, it's not a huge deal, but I just noticed it like in my general appraisal of Hen and Karen's relationship.
I guess they made out better than Buck and Tommy.
Well. Anyway.
But anyways.
We cut from there to Buck is doing a rescue at an arcade, like on the boardwalk or something.
Yep.
And he's getting a little girl out of a claw machine. She's gotten stuck in one of those toy claw machines. Yeah, I thought it was funny that everyone claps when Buck gets her out, because like I know that's like a real world thing, like people tend to do that when first responders like do their job, but it was still kind of funny to me.
That was so shady.
I'm like, wow, you lifted a girl out of a box, wow.
Yeah, you got a cat out of a tree, yeah.
I would clap if I saw a firefighter actually get a cat out of a tree. If anything, just for like fulfilling the stereotype.
Yeah, the novelty of it. But what's cute is that he lets her keep the toy that she wanted. It's like a stuffed cow or something. And he like gives it to her. He's like, I feel like you've earned this, you know?
Yeah. And it's true. She did.
Yeah, she worked hard for it. And then we go from that to Abby is starting her shift at work. And she gets a little call from her long distance relationship. Long distance, of course, because he's at work and she's at work.
Yeah, it's not so long distance anymore, but they presumably have not been back on a date since the oh so romantic emergency tracheotomy.
Yeah, and we learned that it's Buck's first day back. He has some mild discomfort, but they just have a cute little convo, and he asks her if she's buckling in.
I noticed that too, but I have to say, I feel like you really brushed over the part where he opens the phone call by howling like a werewolf, and he also closes the conversation that way, and I just think it's very, like, significant for you and I specifically that there exists an episode of 911 where Buck howls like a werewolf.
I just need to know if there have been crossover fics that have been written, and if not, who in our audience is going to write them? Because
I think you have to write them.
No, right? I'm so knee deep into my own. I can't take on another project. No.
Okay.
But
you're like the Stephen Sondheim of Glee rare pair fan fiction.
I am. I have to finish Follies before I can work on Sunday in the Park with George.
Move on. Okay. They're talking about the full moon thing. Abby does not believe in it.
Yes.
She, like you said, she has like done the research, she's seen the statistics, she doesn't think it's real. Mm-hmm. But Buck's like, just you wait, after tonight you're gonna believe in it.
I can't get over that. There was a she-wolf in that closet, and it's so cute here how they're like establishing like a Mulder and Scully dynamic with them. And like Abby's like the perfect to like, you know, sub in for like a Dana Scully type. So it's like really cute.
It's true.
I honestly think it's like
she
really,
has
really
red
cute.
Hair and everything.
Right. And of course she's played by Perfect Goddess Connie Britton, and Scully was played by Perfect Goddess Gillian Anderson.
True.
And of course Buck has that sweet naivete of a Fox Mulder, but younger and
yeah, Mulder was
somehow
a bit of a
hotter
for his time.
He was. I guess the more modern-ish I guess approach would be Booth and Bones. They were kind of like the 2000s Mulder and Scully a little bit.
No offense to Bones, because I once, like, I used to watch, I think I watched through almost that entire show. I loved it. But, and like, I get the, like, the will they, won't they there was pretty strong. Mm-hmm. But, like, Booth and Bones will low-key never be Mulder and Scully. Like, here's my, okay, this is not a necessary tangent. I'm mm-hmm. so sorry to our listeners. But I feel like Brennan could do Scully, but Booth could not do Mulder.
Could not do Mulder. Kind of, ever.
Yeah. So could that's my ever. Only thing. I always found him, like, of the two, he was the less interesting.
No offense, but also I heard he has, like, abuse allegations against him, so I don't feel that bad. But David mm-hmm. Boreanaz, I just feel like he doesn't have the sauce to be Mulder, you know?
He doesn't have the sauce. I mean, Mulder has, like, that... this is why he's kind of like Buck. Mulder has, like, that... Not only does he have the himbo swag, but he also has, like... sort of a little bit of like not androgynous, but yeah, like a little bit of a, like, he's in touch with his feminine side in a way that is attractive, whereas, like, yeah. Booth is like super macho man, which is kind of less attractive.
Yeah, Booth was like literally like in like the army, and like he works for the FBI and stuff like that, whereas
yeah, his thing is always like when Brennan is doing like cool autistic girl stuff, mm-hmm. Booth is always like, I just want to like eat burgers and play the air guitar.
Yeah, and like that's lame, like grow a personality. Bro,
your personality
your personality can't be like NASCAR and WWE. Like, you have to, like, you know, yeah. It's like you have to like have bring something else to the table, and you know, it could be the sort of the soft quiet poetry of Mulder's paranoid musings, or it could be
yes
the gentle but firm and loving hands of Buck prying open that claw machine.
Okay, tangent over.
Tangent over. We have to get back to the show. But Abby's a skeptic, and
yes,
Buck
Abby's
is a teen
skeptic.
Wolf. And Buck is a teen wolf.
And a she-wolf.
And we cut to a 911 call that I think may have had a very specific inspiration. I don't have evidence for this Ooh. Other than like just the general vibes of the call, but did you ever hear that utterly haunting 911 call, like a real call, of that old lady? She's in her house and she like saw this guy on her porch, and like he was just not moving, and she was just explaining it, and then like halfway through the phone call she just starts like screaming, just violently, like blood-curdling screaming.
No, I did not hear that.
It was crazy. Like they looked into it, apparently it was a real call, but she survived, like no one died. Ugh. But like it was like, it's like harrowing. And like, so like, in like now in like 911, like dispatch schools, they use it as an example of like, why you have to get like the address of a call
right
at the very top. 'Cause the, person on the phone never got the address. And so they didn't actually know where the lady was mm-hmm. and everything. Yeah. It was like,
yeah, that's one of the yeah. least realistic things about 911 is they often, you know, to maximize the drama of any given call, they never have the dispatcher immediately ask for location. They just have them be like, I'm sorry, what are you saying? Or like yeah. a shark on the freeway. Like
literally.
They always have the dispatcher mm-hmm. act a little incredulous first to help hammer home the drama before getting their location.
Yeah. Versus like if you dial 911, the first thing you're going to ask you is 911, what's the location of your emergency, right?
Mm-hmm.
And but yeah, we this call in this episode is there's an old lady. She's in her house and she sees someone that she believes to be standing just outside of her home, like on like the back like stoop. And he's just standing there. He's just staring at her. His face is like cloaked in shadow, and she's like freaking yeah. out, and she ends up having a medical emergency. Right.
Yeah, they send Hen and Chimney to check her out,
yes.
and Athena also to check out, you know, this guy, this prowler,
mm-hmm.
and there's no sign of the guy outside, and the woman's okay. It turns out she probably had a panic attack,
yep.
not a heart attack or mm-hmm. anything like that, but Hen does a little, like, investigating of her own, and she notices that the way this house is set up
mm-hmm.
is that the front door is like this glass door, and it's highly, highly reflective.
Yeah.
And if you stand in just the right place with the light on you, you create this like terrifying optical illusion where it looks like you're standing on the outside, but actually you're standing on the inside. Yeah. So they come to the horrifying realization that the call was coming from inside the house, so to speak.
Yeah.
And the guy was actually inside, which, you know, Athena says, I just got the chills. Yeah. And, you know, we all did as the viewer. This is like one of the creepiest moments in 911.
It was creepy AF. They earned the title with that. There's like obvious mud prints inside the house. And like, it is kind of like, how did you miss that? Because they are very obvious. They're on like a white marble floor. I just gotta point out, did you peep the ceramic cat on her like end table, like next to her couch?
I did not peep the ceramic cat.
There was a ceramic cat. It was everything. But this is a nice ass house. Like, is this like Calabasas or something?
I did notice that. It was
a
very
nice
large
ass house. With like a big like backyard too. Mm-hmm. It's one of those houses that it's like, it's so big, like I wouldn't feel safe living in it. Do you know what I mean?
Right. They ask the old lady, like, do you have anyone you can stay with tonight? She says, I'll call my daughter. Mm-hmm. And I think that's about it.
Yeah, I think that's about where it wraps up. You know, they sort of like insist, like, yeah, don't stay here, because they don't tell her, obviously. They're being discreet and everything, but they're like ushering her out of the house because they know that he was in the house and they know she's not safe there. Interestingly, it is like a question of like, how did he get in? I guess maybe she left the front door unlocked, or maybe he like had a key or knew where the spare key was, or something.
Athena says at one point, like, it looks like he came through right through the front door. So I think it must have been either the door was unlocked or he had a way to get in.
Yeah. And then we go from that to Abby is at work, as she often is. Mm-hmm. And she gets a 911 call. And a lady is freaking out.
Or doesn't the yoga call come first?
No, it goes right to Abby at work. And then let me tell you, this episode has like tonal whiplash and it's like crazy. Like,
okay, I had it written down that the yoga call came first, but I must have been wrong.
Because it would make more sense to come first, because it doesn't make sense to go from this call to yoga call to back to Abby in this sort of harrowing, traumatizing situation. Listen, the show was in its infancy. I'll afford it some grace, but this episode had some tone issues.
Oh, I liked it.
I did too, but it's like they go from the mud prints in the house, very creepy, to just a genuinely harrowing call where this woman is at home, mm-hmm, and like this man whose identity we're not privy to is going full like Jack Torrance in The Shining, like breaking mm-hmm down her door. She's like
breaking down the door.
She's freaking the fuck out, of course, on the call with Abby. She gets the name, she gets the address, and before help can arrive, the man breaks through her bedroom door. She goes, what are you doing here? We hear some sounds of some stabbing happening. We hear some sounds of some stabbing and some butchery happening on the line.
Yeah, he murders her.
Yeah. And that's where it sort of leaves us on that like very like harrowing note. And then mm-hmm we do a hard cut to Buck moldering all over Bobby on a different call.
Yeah, Bobby and Buck definitely have like the comedy B-plot role in this episode.
Yeah.
They roll up to a yoga studio. This, you know, yoga instructor comes out. She's like, quick, she's in here. Here, it's this pose. And Buck is like, oh yeah, what pose does he say? Is it Lotus or what?
I don't remember what it was. It's not Lotus. It's
some specific pose. And Bobby's like, how do you know that? And he says, quote, I've dated like 50 yoga instructors.
Right. And we know what he means by dated.
I'll be the first to say it. That's a lot.
It's a lot. It's a lot.
That's a lot. 50 is a lot. He says like 50, but I mean, even whatever he means by like 50 is surely too many yoga instructors to be having casual sex with. Well, but this is a great call because first we have like someone who's gotten, this is a pregnancy yoga class.
Yeah, it's like a maternity yoga class. That's like the twist
original problem. The original cause of the call is there's a woman who's gotten stuck in a yoga pose, mm-hmm, because she slipped a disc. Her back is hurting. So they start to help her. Suddenly, another woman across the room cries out, and she appears to be going into labor. But, you know, Bobby comes over. He's like, I think it's just Braxton Hicks. Mm-hmm. You should be fine. Then another woman cries mm-hmm out. This woman's water has broken. And they're like, okay, well, we'll get you to the hospital. She says, no, this is my fourth kid or whatever.
It's coming now.
And suddenly another woman goes into labor. Braxton Hicks woman, turns out she's actually in real labor, having real contractions. all these babies are coming like right now today. Mm-hmm. They don't have time to transport them.
Yeah.
The third woman in labor, her baby's head is too big for her pelvis. They're going to need to rush her to the hospital for an emergency C-section. Mm-hmm. But the other two women, like, they just have to deliver these babies now. The woman who's on her fourth kid is she's like, I can deliver the baby. Yeah.
Like, Buck goes over to help her, and like, it turns out she's a doula, and like, obviously it's her fourth baby, so she's just like, little boy, get out of my way, I got this.
That's right. It's not only like, does she already have several kids, but she is a doula, so she's got it under control. Mm-hmm. This other woman has her baby in like 3 seconds.
She wants her epidural.
I have a lore drop for myself to give you right now.
Let's see.
Which is that when I was in high school, I witnessed a woman give birth on the city bus.
What?
Yeah. This is real. Like, you can look it up. Like, it was on the news. I was on the news, actually. interviewing about it. And I was just like on the bus coming home from the movie theater one day. Woman went into labor. And I swear, because some people, like, I've met people who don't believe me when I say how this happened. Like, how fast it happened, but this really can happen. Because this woman, like, she went into labor, bus driver pulled over, called 911, and before the ambulance even got there, her baby was born. So it's like, it does happen.
Did she deliver it herself, or did they have, like, a doctor on the bus, or?
We didn't have a doctor, but a guy kind of stepped up and delivered the baby. It was crazy. It was a beautiful, life-affirming moment.
Wow. Well, I'm really, like, I'm jazzed that you had that, like, lovely experience. It sounds like it was a wonderful experience. I've just never heard of anything like that happening in real life. Wow.
Well, you have now. I mean, it was, this was like my 911 scenario, like the closest I've ever come to being in an episode of 911.
Did you call 911? Did you call the?
No, I think the bus driver called 911.
Mm-hmm. And you were just you were a bystander.
I was a bystander. Some people got off the bus and some of us didn't. I probably should have, but I think me and like one other, I think we kind of were trying to see if we could help. Mm-hmm. And there was one woman who got on the phone with her mom, who was a midwife, and she started asking around. She's like, does anyone have a shoelace? Because we can use it to clamp the umbilical cord.
Oh.
So I gave this lady my shoelace, and then it didn't even end up getting used. So I just went home with one shoelace.
Right. Okay. You didn't even get your shoelace back?
No, I guess not.
I guess if they used it to clamp the umbilical cord, you might not want it back.
True. Mm-hmm. But I mean, it didn't get used for anything. So actually, yeah, I don't know if she just kept it or if I just didn't get it off the floor or what.
Do you think she just has it in like a drawer somewhere? Like, oh, this is that girl's shoelace. Maybe. I'm sure I'll get it back to her one day.
or she like consciously stole it. Her mom wasn't even a midwife. She was just pretending because she wanted my shoelace.
Or attention.
Or attention. That was crazy.
That's genuinely crazy. Wow. did you have a yogi?
We didn't have a yogi on duty, as far as I know.
Because like,
I was coming home from seeing the movie Eighth Grade by Bo Burnham.
Oh my god.
So I kind of didn't have time to process the movie.
Yeah,
all that happened.
Wow. Interesting. So you had a crazy night.
It was the day. It was like afternoon. I had to go to work after at the ice cream shop.
So sees Eighth Grade, witnesses childbirth, goes to work like a 7-hour shift at an ice cream shop.
All in a day's work for 17-year-old Jane.
All in a day's work. Jesus Christ. That's awesome. That's awesome.
Yeah. That was a crazy day.
Wow. In this call, like, I'm just imagining, like, if you were on the bus and you had, like, a yogi there mm-hmm. in everyone's ear just being like, you know, the full moon brings fertility and many cultures talk about how it aids childbirth. And, like, just, like, being on the bus and be like, this is not the time!
Shut up. No, because she does say that in this call.
Mm-hmm.
She kind of, unhelpfully goes, some people think the full moon, can induce labor.
Right.
It's like, obviously.
Clearly, right. But if anything, it's just another drop in Buck's hat and being like, oh, Mulder is right yet again.
Right. His superstition is only proven right throughout the entire episode.
Mm-hmm.
But we get, at the end of this call, Buck mentions to the women, he's like, you know, that's Bobby and I'm Buck in case you want to name your kids after us.
And she's like, no.
Which is funny, but also it's like, come on, like, why would we name our babies Buck? Like, no offense.
Literally. If anything, I'd name it Bobby. Bobby's so much cuter for a baby.
Bobby is cute, but yeah, even that. It's weird that he gave them both their nicknames instead of like their birth names.
I'm Evan. This is Robert. If you want to name them after us.
Can you imagine naming a baby Robert? Because people must do it because there are people named Robert in the world. But I can't imagine looking at a newborn baby being like, yeah, that's a Robert.
Buck, obviously, he offers them to name the babies after him and Bobby. Very Buck move. Obviously, they say no. The doula lady specifically says no. And then we hard cut back from that very, almost comically lighthearted call. Like, it's, like, mm-hmm. lighthearted in, like, the way that it would be lighthearted for any episode of 9-1-1, not even just this episode.
Yeah, it's very comedic.
And then we hard cut from that back to Abby in shock over hearing a woman be brutally murdered. And we get the first appearance of the diva herself, Sue Blevins.
Cue the air horns. I love Sue for some reason. I just love how, like, I think I said it in my video, but she's just like a nice, stern boss mm-hmm. who looks out for her employees.
Yeah, yeah. Reliable. Someone you'd want to be in charge. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're sort of like, I guess, debriefing after that because she's in shock. You know, it's a very difficult thing to hear, of course.
She's struggling to shake this call.
Yeah, she's struggling, as she says later on, to move on to the next one, right? And mm-hmm. a wild detective appears. And says that he would like to listen to the call. I don't know about you, but the first time I watched this episode, I was absolutely convinced the detective was the real killer.
Oh, what?
I was absolutely convinced. Because
that would have been so fun.
I know, because just think about it. It's like they've already got the husband in custody. Like, he listens to the call. Right. He doesn't have much of a reaction to it. And whenever she tries to question him, he's very dismissive about it. And he's mm-hmm. sort of like, he's kind of blasé. He's like, you know, like he says later on, like 99% of the time, the person you think did it. And so like the way that I first read that scene was, oh, he's the killer and he's coming back to listen to his kill and enjoy it again.
That would have been great. I guess I sort of didn't think that mm-hmm. because I was just like resigned to the depressing reality of like, oh, he's just like a typical arrogant cop who's bad at his job. But yeah, the cop is being very dismissive towards Abby because Abby kind of thinks that there's more going on here. So Abby calls over their sort of technical guy at the dispatch, Terry. I think this might be Terry's first. No, I think Terry shows up a few episodes before.
It's her gay coworker.
Calls him over.
One of her.
Okay, can we? Okay, I'm so sorry to keep going on tangents. Can we talk about Terry? Because I cut out a line about this in my video too. That for some reason, I always thought that they were setting up Terry and Josh at the dispatch.
How cute would that be? How cute would that
be? I'm sorry, but because it's funny you say Terry is gay because they've never said that, but I also always assumed that, right?
It just kind of seems
like he is. I'm sorry. So, you know, when you have Josh, especially, like, there are moments when they do interact when it kind of feels like they're flirting with each other, like mm-hmm. in that episode in season 5 when Josh suddenly gets a love interest who then never shows up again.
Yeah.
It's like, I thought it was going to be a Terry-Josh episode until that random love interest showed up.
Yeah. But Terry and Josh would have been so cute!
I'm just saying, like, it's right there. It's kind of weird to me that they've never gone there.
And, like, we all know Terry has, like, a bad case of the gay face, you know?
I don't want to be rude, but it's weird that we both assumed he was gay, even though the show never said that.
Because he is! Just look at his face!
So anyway, tangent over, tangent over.
But
we're talking about characters that don't even exist yet.
But Abby has Terry look through this 911 caller's history, see if there's any other calls made from her or her residence in the past 3 years. He gets mm-hmm. to work because he is a great gay best friend. And we find out that Abby would be a great private investigator.
True, true. A lot of Abby detective work in this episode. We go from there to another 911 call of somebody. There's just a guy on the loose, like, going, attacking homeless people. crazy guy, crazed look in his eye. We don't know what's up with him.
Yeah.
Athena, Hen, and Chimney again respond to this, and it appears to be somebody like totally out of his head on bath salts.
Yeah.
Because he starts eating the face of someone. Which, of course, is a classic, like, crazy news headline of, like,
yeah,
person on bath salts mm-hmm. eating someone's face.
Yeah.
Like, that's a Florida man, mm-hmm. whatever, kind of classic headline. Yeah.
But again, like, aesthetically mirroring a Halloween episode, because he's giving, like, pure, mm-hmm. like, zombie core right now eating this face. Like, we see, like, the chunks of flesh
yeah.
out of this guy's throat, and, like, it falls from his mouth. He's got blood all over his mouth, and it's like, where have you seen
we
that?
Even get...
The Walking Dead.
Exactly. And we even get, like, a POV shot...
Oh my God!
From him,
his POV shot
of what he's seeing, and it's like Athena with like glowing like demon eyes.
Yes.
So it's a funny situation because it's like she ends up having to shoot the guy because she tries, you know, he starts charging her.
She tries to
tase him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
She tases him, and he just like rips the things out of his chest, like he's completely. It's like he is a zombie, like unkillable. So
yeah.
she just like, she shoots him like in the chest and he just doesn't go down. And then finally she shoots him in the head.
Yeah.
And like, you know, my brain wants to say she should have found another way, but the show does depict it as like he was essentially a zombie and just there was nothing that could take him down.
It does.
And he was actively eating someone's face.
Yeah.
So.
Like that's a pretty credible threat when he has the fresh blood of this person's jugular dripping down his chin. I feel like, mm-hmm. like if there is an instance where I can be like okay with this, it is in this moment, just based on the literal depiction of events in the show.
right. So you know, Athena does that. We even it's interesting they do still depict that like she has to deal with some bureaucracy after that. Like she
yeah.
says, I might have to be on desk duty for a few days while they sort it out, but whatever.
Yeah.
Hen, you know, finishes her job and gets a phone call. And it's Eva.
And it's Eva.
Her seductive and volatile ex,
yeah.
who we previously saw in prison, but has now apparently gotten out of prison. And she's like at a seedy motel and she's calling Hen and she's like, come over, babe. I have a, you know, the place I'm staying at. It's not much, but it has a bed.
Yeah. It's like the most, like, and... it's the most fucking, like, she couldn't be more explicit if she tried. And of course, Hen,
yeah.
who is still into her, hashtag paramour still into you, you know, she's humoring this, right? She's humoring it.
Like, she is. She's humoring it way too much.
Far more than is appropriate or called for in any way.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
And, but, you know, Eva, like, she claims to be doing well. She has an entry-level job at, like, a small tax firm. And it's like, you know, good for you. You know, it sounds like you're kind of
mm-hmm.
getting your life back on track. But that doesn't change the fact that Hen has a wife.
Hen is fully married, not with this woman.
Mm-hmm.
Hen's, like, drowning in beautiful women who want to have sex with her.
I know. The nightmare.
Which... she's like, what do I do? But you know, she hangs up the call. Athena kind of comes over and susses it out. She's like, that wasn't your wife on the phone, was it?
Mm-hmm.
And she tells her, you know, just so you know, you can't ignore these problems with your marriage or like stagnation in your marriage, because you know these things can, you know, I thought my marriage was fine and then the next day the bomb went off. And then, you know, Hen says, like, Karen's not a bomb waiting to go off. And Athena says, I wasn't talking about her.
Yeah.
I love Athena just basically says, you're the drama.
You're the drama. Isn't
you're the problem.
Am I the drama? No, I'm not. No.
Hen very much is the drama.
It very much is. This interaction actually got me thinking about the fact that we really haven't seen Michael in a spell, have we?
No, which is part of why I was so confused when you said he's main cast.
I know. It's like, where is he being billed every episode? If so, he has a great agent.
Right. I know. So that's why I was confused, is like he's just simply not on the show as much as the main characters.
Yeah. But sort of leaves us on that like ominous note of like, is Hen mm-hmm. going to, you know, destabilize the happy marriage.
Yeah, yes, to quote, I think it was Jenny Nicholson's Greatest Showman review.
Oh my god, she says, great video.
She's gonna cheat on her wife alarms start going off.
Mm-hmm. And we go from that, great reference, and we go from that to we are back at dispatch, and Abby is showing the two different 911 calls that they dug up to the detective, and the differences sort of therein, right? 3 years ago, there was another 911 call. Her ex-husband, who very abusive, was at the door, and she was like, you know, demanding that, you know, he get off her property in a very sort of like almost like a self-possessed way, obviously.
Yeah, she was just being a little more forceful about it. She's like, I'm on the phone with the cops. Like, if you want to spend another night in jail, you can keep doing that. Yeah. Like, she's clearly pushing back, whereas in this call from tonight, she was like very realistically afraid, and like when the guy came in, it sounded like she recognized the guy, but not in a like, oh boy, like you're back, like how dare you, I've got a restraining order kind of way, but more of a like, you, what are you doing here kind of way.
And it's like it's like Abby, a intentional dichotomy. Yeah. There's like real terror in that call, right? And so Abby's like noticing that, and she's trying to like show that to the detective, and obviously that detective is like, well, that's one for the file. Like,
yeah. We'll put this in our archive and do nothing with it.
Mm-hmm. And like Abby's being like really real about like, you know, this woman's experience. Like she's like approaching it like intentionally, you know, from the woman's perspective, which obviously this man, you know, either is unable to or is willfully avoiding putting himself into. And like, you know, it's just another example of police douchebaggery.
Listen, Ryan, trying to get inside the mind of your female victim is gay, okay?
You're right. It is gay.
Jot that down.
I actually heard that from Abby's gay coworker.
Oh, yeah?
Sorry, one of her gay coworkers. We haven't met the other one yet. But
everybody in this town.
Everyone in this town. It's L.A., you know, California, et cetera.
So she leaves that meeting feeling very condescended by the guy. She has a great line where she's like, well, at least he didn't pat me on the head.
Right.
But I think after that, she calls Athena, who's like on desk duty at the station.
Not right away. Her gay friend shows her that he was able to dig up in the depths of this audio recording by bass boosting it or whatever, he was able to dig up a second voice, you know. And it's like it's almost comical the way that they edit it in, because like they play the clip and then they play it again and he's like, what, you didn't hear it? And then they play the same clip unaltered, but they added in the third voice line.
Yeah. Like I was also noting, like, what just happened there?
Right. It's like, oh, and suddenly the magic touch, a third voice appeared. Right.
Listen, Terry's a magician when it comes to audio.
Mm-hmm. It's like on SVU when they have like the CSI like text like defuzz the security cam footage or whatever.
Right. Enhance.
Enhanced, right. That technology totally exists.
Yeah, you can just create information where there is none.
Mm-hmm. And then, you know, and then she calls Athena at the LAPD. You know, she's welcome. She's on desk duty, of course, as she said earlier, and she gets a call from Abby. Oh, and before she does, can we just call attention to this horrible, horrible line that is in every piece of cop media in existence? And I hate it, and I cringe every time I hear it, when her superior says to her, it was a good shoot. Like, quote, it was a good shoot. It's like, I've heard it so many times on like cop shows that it's like triggering in my brain. It's just like no.
Interesting that they see it as like any shoot being good.
Right. It's like, is this a colloquialism or is this just like your perspective on this job? Like, interesting. Okay.
But she gets the call from Abby and kind of they start to sort this out. They realize that you know, there's this crossover between the call Abby took earlier from the older woman. Because it turns out, you know, the third voice in that call from a few years ago or whatever is someone named Nora Jane Curtis or something. And they're like, wait a minute, that older woman who called earlier was named Nora Curtis. Turns out they're mother and daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they realize they're staying together and this guy might come after them.
Yeah, it's like a George H.W. George W. Bush thing. Right.
Yeah.
And so Abby calls Athena, all that stuff. Right. Nora Jane is, we find out. And I think, okay, where in this scene are werewolves mentioned? Because I think Athena mentions werewolves at some
point. Yes. I also took note of this. Abby says something about, like, I'm starting to buy into this whole, you know, full moon thing. Mm-hmm. And Athena says, still haven't seen no werewolves.
Right. And that's because she don't work in Beacon Hills.
Not yet. She doesn't.
Not yet. Imagine that crossover.
Not until we get this crossover.
Imagine that crossover. Wow.
If there can be a Teen Wolf movie in 2023, there is still potential for a Teen Wolf 911 crossover.
I mean, they're doing Abbott in Always Sunny, so I think stranger things have happened. I just have written down, love the way this ep is written. This is so good. I think, okay. Oh, you know why? You know why? Because they tied that first call back into the second call with Abby. Mm. And I'm like, oh, this is really tight storytelling. I'm loving this.
Yeah, it's pretty fun.
I love planting and payoff. I don't know. I just I'm a fan of it.
Well, then, yeah, we get Nora Jane and her mom are, you know, settling down for the night. Yep. The mom is staying with the daughter because, of course, the scary thing at her house, they get a call from Abby. And at first, Nora Jane is like, oh, wow, like you're checking up on us, like the 911 dispatcher. That's so nice. But Abby starts to ask some questions about, like, her relationship with this woman who died and gets the answers that basically this woman who was murdered tonight led this, like, support group for victims of domestic violence, right?
Mm-hmm.
And she had helped Nora Jane escape her abusive relationship, I think.
Yeah, to the point where, like, they were, like, friends, and, like, you know, like Nora Jane even stayed at her house at one point.
So Abby kind of deduces very quickly that this must be Nora Jane's abusive ex-husband, who first went after Nora Jane's mom's house because she thought Nora Jane would be staying there.
Yep.
Then I'm just realizing how convoluted this is to, like, explain after the fact.
You had to be there, kids.
You had to watch the episode. My condolences to anyone listening to this podcast who, like, isn't watching the show
wants
to hear the podcast, because I think there are a few people doing that. Believe us when we tell you it's more fun to just watch the show.
Yeah, it's a watch along. What are you doing if you're not watching along? I'm sorry. You can watch however you want, but, like,
guys, I'm not going to insult them. I'm just saying I'm sorry that you have to listen to our convoluted recapping. But yeah, so the guy went to Nora Jane's mom's house, didn't find Nora Jane there. So then he went to the friend's house because he was mad because he perceives her as, like, having driven him and Nora Jane apart, right? So he kills her. Comes back, and now he's coming for Nora Jane's house. So Abby, like, gets help on the way, but the guy, it's kind of too late. He's already there outside the house. Mm-hmm. He, like, chases them upstairs, throws open the shower curtain in the bathroom.
Gotta say, absolute unit of a man busting down doors with his bare fists.
Yeah, no, brute force. A lot of brute force on this guy.
Yeah,
and but then, you know, he, like, busts his way into the bathroom because he thinks Nora Jane is in there. Instead, he finds the mom.
Yeah,
and he kind of hesitates, and Nora Jane gets the opportunity to sneak up behind him with a baseball bat and beat him to death.
Beats his ass with a baseball death, fucking deserved. And it was so good to see.
It was satisfying. I mean, she says something about, like, I was ready this time. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, she had really been, honestly, just waiting for her opportunity.
Yeah, like, seriously. And they were safe. I will say, though, the mom in the shower, like, I know she put her in the bathroom and, like, locked the door to protect her, but the way that it played out, it did kind of make it seem like the mom was bait.
Well, we find out later that apparently the husband always had, like, sort of a soft spot for the mom, which is why he didn't murder her when he broke into her house earlier, and then why he hesitated when he found her in the bathroom. So maybe they did plan it, but, you know, accounting for the fact that he probably wouldn't hurt the mom.
Yeah. And then we get possibly the craziest vibe shift, not just in this episode, but possibly any episode of any show ever.
It is kind of giving the school shooting episode of Degrassi, where the B-plot in that episode is Joey trying to sell his house. This call is So amazing.
This is one of my favorite calls in the entire show.
I was going to say, because it revolves around like this gay couple, wealthy gay couple. Oh my God, their house. When we see their house, it's insane.
The fireplace, the bathroom.
Like such a wildly, like lavishly decorated place. It's this gay couple. Mm-hmm. First of all, did you notice that the guy, the guy with the tapeworm is the Nazi werewolf from season 6A of Teen Wolf?
Yes, I did. I had a moment where I'm like, I know he looks familiar, and then it dawned on me, and I was like, no, many werewolf connections
in this episode. It was Der Soldat himself.
And gotta say, better use of the actor in this episode than all of 6A.
Yeah. Having seen this, I'm very impressed by his range, honestly.
Yeah. this gay boy, right, who probably works in Hollywood, and his boyfriend or husband, who's presumably a writer of some sort, given the way that he waxes poetical about quite literally everything.
I like that you read into it like this, because that didn't even cross my mind.
Well, they're rich and they're in LA. This is just, you know.
Yeah. So screenwriter and his trophy actor husband.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the headcanon that I like to go with.
Yeah. I mean, they're both very good looking.
He calls 911. One of them is in the Nazi teacher that was eating people's pineal glands. Calls 911.
Which, to be clear, he only did that in Teen Wolf. He does not do that in 911.
That we know
of. Or in real life, as far as we know.
That we know of, yes. He calls 911, and he's having a little, like, maybe a little Reagan in The Exorcist moment. You know, something's, like, inside of him, and he's, like, he feels it twisting around in his gut, right, and everything, and he's freaking the fuck out. And who should show up?
His husband is kind of like exasperated with him this whole time. Yeah. It's clear that like he's maybe been having this issue. And what I kind of, the way that you were obsessed with that couple in episode 2, like the guy who's threatening to jump off the building, this was like that for me, where I was like, I need like an entire spinoff about these two.
Who should, of course, show up to respond to this call but boy kissing bisexual Evan Buck Buckley and his surrogate father?
He really, something about the way he was like really getting along with this gay guy made it feel like, I wrote in my notes, this is what I wrote in my notes at this point, Buck being queer baby boy.
Aww. So Oliver Stark referenced this, I think Tim Minear referenced this too, as being like, maybe one of the first hints that there might be something LGBT going on with Buck after the whole 704 thing happened. They reference this offhand along with another call from season 2, just about Buck being comfortable around gay people, right? Just like his sort of like almost like unusually so.
Because I'm not trying to say like, oh, he must be queer because he like is friendly with this gay guy. No, it's like they start, it's hard to explain, but they start like speaking each other's language.
They do. They really do.
They start talking about like their low carb diets.
They're like, have you tried the brown really rice bonding. And like, what's your body mass index? Oh, I try to stay around like 15% body fat.
Yeah, what's your
like,
body fat percentage?
But like, I remember I was watching this for the first time and seeing Buck be so comfortable with these guys. Like, I was 18, right? And I was like watching and I was just like, are times really changing? Are straight guys just this comfortable with gay guys? Oh my God. What is what a world.
Straight guys, no. What a world. Closeted bisexual men.
And so when Buck came out, like part of me was like a very small part of me was kind of sad because I'm like, we didn't have that straight guys just being like super chill with gay guys like representation anymore. Even though we got much better rep out of it with the open bisexual himself. But that's a spoiler, so we're going to leave that out.
To be fair, had this call been like Bobby and Chimney, I could see like Chimney having the exact same interaction with this guy.
But that's why everyone thinks Chimney's bi too.
Oh, true. I forgot that's like a phantom thing.
This little gay boy's name is Connor. He has been apparent according to his husband, Paul, he's been getting gassy recently, right?
And he's been getting gassy. They're doing this dynamic where, like, Connor doesn't want to admit any of this to the you know, Bobby and Buck, and then his husband keeps being like, just tell them you've like been having diarrhea.
Yeah, he's like getting embarrassed. It's like, it's like the bottom with IBS. Like, he never wants to cop to it, but he's been getting sushi like 4 to 5 times per week.
Oh yeah, they say they eat a ton of sushi, yeah. Which is like clue number one. The guy just feels like he's having terrible stomach cramps. He feels like he's gonna explode.
Then, you know, they start bonding over their health and fitness stuff, just like offhand. They start talking and they say, we need to move this guy to the ambulance because something's going on, right?
They get into the ambulance.
And Buck is holding his hand. Like, Buck is holding his
hand. Oh, yeah. I also wrote that down. Like, his husband is holding one hand and Buck is holding the other like he's giving birth in the hospital.
Oh, well,
Well, but then the guy's like, no, like, really, like, I feel something moving under my leg. And it turns out he's got a big old tapeworm coming out of his butt.
Enormous tapeworm.
Yeah, Buck is shockingly comfortable with this. If anything, he seems to just be sort of, like, academically curious about it. Yeah. Where instead of being, you know, Bobby's really grossed out, and Buck is just like, wow, it's cool.
And so he
says that he has experience with this because, you know, he used to tend bar in South America, yeah. Because of course he has, and he would see a lot of this.
Yeah. And so he, like, you know, Bobby's like, you know, he's fine delivering children, but squeamish about tapeworms, which is, you know, whatever. It's like
squeamish about delivering tapeworms.
I would probably be squeamish about both personally, but that's just me. I just don't like getting my hands dirty. Mm-hmm. But Buck slaps on a pair of latex gloves and starts pulling it out one by one. And gotta say, good for the Nazi teacher who's eating people's pineal glands, because that worm is coming out clear. And, you know...
Stop it. The husband says something... says something really funny where he's like, oh, it's like the handkerchief... it's like the handkerchief clown trick. Or whatever. Oh, yeah. Huh? Because, yeah, he keeps pulling it out. He says at one point, he's like, wow, this has got to be like 7 or 8 feet or something.
Yeah. It was it. And, like, he has to be gentle with it because obviously it can't break. Because, like, if it breaks and it goes back in, mm-hmm. It's going to regenerate and everything. And it's another problem. Worms. Yeah. It is thick, and it is, like, a long-ass tapeworm. But, like, it's, like, I don't know why. I expected it to be flatter. It's, like, round. It's, like, got, like, the body shape of an earthworm.
Well, it was also, like, a fake tapeworm, right? Like, right. That's not a real tapeworm. So I think in real life they are a little flatter.
Yeah. I feel like they're probably pretty fragile, too. So I'm just surprised at Buck's gentleness. You
know. Okay. I had a little connection to season 6 here.
Okay. Okay, let's
hear it. People are going to call me crazy. But listen. So this guy's name is Connor, right? Mm-hmm. And at the end of this sequence, when he gets the tapeworm out, Buck says, congratulations, Connor, it's a boy. Mm-hmm. Now, so I'm sorry to like talk about season 6. This isn't, it's technically a spoiler, but this doesn't have much bearing on the plot in the end, so I feel like I can tell you. Buck decides to become a sperm donor in season 6, and he decides to do this for his friend, whose name is also Connor. It's a different Connor. And he ends up even delivering the baby, at which point, I mean, Connor isn't there, but he delivers it and hands it to the wife, and he says, it's a boy. So, for the record, Buck has now delivered 2 things that came from a guy named Connor.
2 things.
And had to say, wow. And said, it's a boy. Coincidence? Maybe.
Jane.
What?
Do you know, I'm just gonna voice this very neutrally as possible, but do you know why I think it is a coincidence?
What's that?
Because one of those things was a baby, and one was a tapeworm.
Okay, but like the joke is that he's saying it's a boy as if the tapeworm is a baby.
It's a tapeworm!
Yeah, but I'm saying, like, maybe someone was watching back to season 1 and was like, oh, wouldn't it be funny if for my sperm donation storyline I want to do, I made it a guy named Connor and I had it be a boy.
Yes, but that would imply that any thought or love went into the sperm donation storyline. So,
you know what? Touche. You're right. But I just wanted to bring it up because I thought that was a fun little 911 baby tapeworm connection.
No, that was a fun 911 baby tapeworm connection.
That baby and that tapeworm are basically cousins.
And so we go from that wonderful call, which successfully, in my opinion, lightened the mood.
Yeah, that was a great sequence.
A great sort of detox or a little antidote to the batshit insanity of the rest of the episode and sort of almost the dourness of the rest of the episode. I actually forgot that that call was in this episode. I thought it was completely separate.
Right. Yeah.
But then we go from that to Abby back at the dispatch center. And the detective shows up.
Mr. Not the Murderer Detective comes by to apologize.
It would have been so great.
It would have been.
I could have said a cab. It would have been great.
Well, that's the thing. This show can never have a cop be the bad guy.
I know. They can have the firefighter be the bad guy before the cop. The detective, the chauvinist pig, as he is known, apologizes.
Mm-hmm.
Like sincerely, seemingly apologizes to Abby. And I was just thinking, man, Abby would be a better detective than him. Yeah, maybe she should.
Genuinely would. Yeah, it would have been great if we had found out, like, after season one that she, like, stopped being a dispatcher and now she's just a full-on, like, you know, because she did, like, go travel Europe. Maybe she's, like, a Poirot-style detective.
That would have been so great. Or if she was, like, Columbo or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
That would have been so fucking fun.
Connie Britton in her Connie Britton voice saying, just one more thing.
Yeah.
Well, from there we go to Athena calling Hen.
Yes.
And did she just call her to say, it turns out the guy wasn't on bath salts at all? He was just had alcohol in his system?
Yeah, it was just a guy going through something, apparently.
He was just having a bit of a night.
He was just having one hell of a night. I think they probably meant to, like, resolve that, but then maybe they ran out of time, like running time or something. Like, they mentioned,
I mean, I think that is the resolution. It's just like, ooh, it's creepy that he wasn't on anything.
They mentioned in the in the Hulu episode description that the guy was, like, rabid or something. So I expected, like, a rabies thing. But that's not even how rabies presents in humans.
No, I don't think so. I mean, it does make you aggressive. But yeah, I don't know if you'd be, like, eating someone's face aggressive.
Yeah.
I feel like you might just be dead by that point.
Yeah. So it's literally just a call to be like, no bath salts were involved in this manslaughter.
No, but I mean, don't you get it? Like, that's what makes it creepy AF.
I know. That's what makes it creepy AF. leaving it on that unknown.
And in that sense, I think it's great.
Yeah.
But Athena, you know, Hen conspicuously mentions early on in the call, like, Athena asks, like, are you heading home or something? And Hen's like, yeah. But it turns out at the end of this scene, after she hangs up, she actually goes to Eva's motel.
And of course, and they be fucking.
Well, they have a little moment where it's like, you know, you're here and, like, you look good and whatever. And
he says, freedom agrees with me. Like,
yeah,
that's a great line. Freedom agrees with me. And it's like,
it's like they're in, like, a 1940s. It's like they're in a noir or something.
Yeah. But, a rendezvous at a motel.
She, like, comes to the shady motel. Mm-hmm. She's like, well, I really shouldn't be getting it on with a dame like you. But she does. And Hen officially cheats on her wife. I wrote in my notes, all caps, no, Hen, don't do it, no.
Not Tracy Toms. Tracy Toms. Think about Tracy Toms.
What did Tracy Toms ever do to deserve this? Nothing.
Nothing.
Nothing in her life.
Nothing, except starring in the horrible Rent movie.
I mean, it's not that much worse than the horrible Rent musical.
That's true. Okay, that's true. That's true. Then, of course, you know, so they start making out. And then we hard cut to Buck rolling up to Abby's with a bottle of red wine.
Hard cut to Abby.
Right. Yes.
It's kind of interesting. First, we just see Abby in her house. She sees the knock on the door, and you can kind of see it spook her a little bit, like, because of the day she's had.
Yeah.
But she checks the peephole. It's Buck. She opens the door. He's got a bottle of wine in hand.
And he blames it on the moon.
Like, he blames it on the moon. He's like, you know, I just suddenly found myself pulling into the liquor store, getting this bottle of wine, and driving to your house.
Yeah.
And they sort of have some adorable, sexy banter about whether it was science or magic or something else.
Mm-hmm. And
then we get our first Babby sex scene.
Yes. Come on, Babby.
First Babby non-phone, in-person sex scene. Yeah.
While this was happening, I just wrote down the line, shacking up with a himbo half her age. For no reason. At all. No reason in
particular. And you know what, Tommy? She was having the time of her life.
And was.
Without you.
And was. Without you.
But Buck and Abby, you know, they finally just do it.
Yep.
And it's great. And I can't, as always, like, we can't explain this, but we have become full-on Buck Abby shippers.
Yes. Yes.
maybe not shippers, because it's not like we're, like, writing fan fiction or anything, but, or, like, seeking out gifts and stuff. But I do feel like we're both obviously into this relationship, and I was into this scene.
Yeah, Buck Abby narrative enjoyers. And I was really into this scene too. Like, I was feeling like Abby's sort of like her whole thing. I was like, damn girl, you get some. Okay? Like,
exactly, exactly.
So into
it. It's like in like season 15 or 16 of Grey's Anatomy when Meredith is suddenly being pursued by not one but two hot younger men, DeLuca and Link.
Mm-hmm.
And briefly, I remember that's like when my interest in the show revived, because I was like, oh, this is like cool. This is like if you're like Bachelor Nation watching this show, you're like, ooh, the fantasy of like the sort of attractive older woman like being desirable and desired by all these hot young men.
Mm-hmm.
And like that's the story and she's in control. I thought it was great.
Yeah.
Anyway, mm-hmm. I also wanted to say Buck Abby narrative enjoyers, aka Bane.
Oh my god.
Just, Bane, you know, if that means anything to anyone.
Before I put on the mask.
Sorry, not a Nolan Bane impression in 2024.
But I did write down also kind of upsetting that these two sex scenes are cut together. Because,
mm-hmm.
like, you're into the Buck and Abby sex scene, you're not into and cheating on her wife montage.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Although, honestly,
and then
okay, we're not into it because we know Karen and we love Karen and we love Tracy Toms.
True, for like a maybe first time viewer at the time
isn't
would have just been intrigued.
Probably isn't that invested in Karen as a character necessarily, unless mm-hmm. of course they immediately latch on to the lesbian domesticity, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or they just think
or
they're
Tracy
cute
Toms,
together.
If they're already Tracy Toms enjoyers,
exactly. But if you're just like a casual viewer. You might be just watching this and thinking, like, especially like if you're a woman who loves women, then you might be watching this and thinking, yes, lesbians on my screen.
I don't know.
Like, I certainly have had that moment with, like, gays, you know?
Yeah, like, you don't really care if it's, like, a good story.
Yeah,
cause, exactly.
Because you're not quite there with the characters yet, but you're still loving what they're mm-hmm. doing, you know?
Sure.
But I don't know if that holds water. I don't know.
It's like on Dante's Cove.
Oh my
when
god.
Ambrosius Valin, the evil warlock, seduces the young Kevin.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You would love Dante's
it's
Cove.
Just
it's
like
so fucking
that.
Funny.
I have to watch it.
It's so funny.
I've been looking for a new show to watch, so that might be the one to do.
I'll just like upload all the episodes onto a Google Drive
please,
and I'll send it to you.
Please. Yes. Do like a mega file or something like that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We can just torrent it to each other.
But I was just watching like these like intercut sex scenes, like and like how like mm-hmm. you know, like they're brief and they're cloaked in shadow, but they are pretty physical and they're pretty revealing and everything, and
mm-hmm.
and I was just thinking like there was absolutely like if this was in season one, there was absolutely no excuse for chaste Buck Tommy in 7 and 8.
Well, yeah, I mean, I will say though, in general, I think the show has gotten more chaste, like on the whole. Like, I'm not trying to excuse that because it was extremely weird.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, like I would say in all of the couples, less. I feel like season one had more sexual content than the rest of the seasons.
That's true. That's definitely true.
And if we do get it in the later seasons, it's often like less than this. It's more like a cutaway. Sometimes with Eddie, you would get like a right after he just stopped having sex. Like you cut to like him and Shannon or him and Marisol like breathing heavily. Season one definitely is more explicit, I would say.
Definitely.
But I wrote down one more thing, which is, when they cut to after the fact and it's like Buck and Abby spooning and Abby is the little spoon. I was really hoping it would cut to that and Buck would be the little spoon.
Oh, little baby girl.
Come on, like I feel like Abby tops.
Oh, absolutely.
I just thought it would be a funny detail, I guess. That's what I would have done.
Well, we have unusual tastes, Anastasia. But then it cuts from Abby not spooning Buck to Hen back on the beach, just like she was in the opening.
Mm-hmm.
And it does that thing that I love. It's so simple, and it's so, like, you know, it's done all the time, but I love it whenever I see it. It's whenever an episode of a show takes place overnight, or like a movie takes place all in one night or something, and it ends on the sun rising. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know, there's just something about that I love. It's just like, oh, the story is complete. Ooh, bookend. Mm-hmm. I don't know, I just loved it.
And
she has like,
and
a,
that is the end of the episode.
She has a little outro monologue, and yeah, that's it. That's the end. And I think that this was a damn good episode.
I think it was. We got some real creepy AF moments. Dare I say, some funny AF moments.
Yes, we did. Yes, we did. We got some damn good, you know, relationship moments, and some damn frustrating relationship moments. And that's what drama is all about, mm-hmm. you know?
It is. It's like, as much as if you ever hear us criticizing things in the story, we're not always saying that they, like, shouldn't have happened, just that, like, they're hard to watch, but, like, it's kind of necessary to have an interesting story a lot of the time.
Yeah, because, like, these are our children, right? Like, I feel like that's, like, what happens when you get invested enough in a show or a fandom. The characters just become your little babies. And so when they start doing bad things, you want to, like, punish them and scold them like a parent. I like the continued trend that began last episode of, like, a very call-focused episode. Sort of, like, a very extreme call situation-focused episode and character drama interspersed therein. So I think that was, like, a really good sort of, like, flow style for the episode, and it afforded the characters the opportunity to sort of play off of situations and riff off situations in a natural way, because they were so swamped at work that it sort of forced certain things to come up in the moment. You know what I mean?
I'll never understand. I totally understand fans who, like, want a good balance of that and character drama, but I'll never understand the fans who, like, consider the 911 call episodes, like, filler, or who, like, want less of that. It's like, come on, like, the point of the show at the end of the day is the crazy 911 calls. Yeah. And, like, that's my first priority. And after that, I'll think about characters. Yeah. My last on my list of priorities is cop stuff. Yeah. I can always do with less of that. On that note, thanks for listening to this episode. And you can, of course, follow us on our social medias. It'll be in the description.
Mm-hmm. First Risk Podcast, spelled how it sounds, on all platforms.
As always.
Excluding Instagram. Do we have an Instagram yet?
No, we don't.
No, we don't.
Why would we?
Why?
Listen, what would we post? We're an audio-only podcast.
We could post.
What pictures would we post?
Eddie's beautiful face.
Just, even though we haven't even covered his episodes yet. Anyway, remember to rate us 5 stars.
Yes.
I don't actually know if that, like, does anything in, like, the algorithm of Spotify, but it's fun for me to check our Spotify every once in a while and see how many 5-star ratings we have.
It's great for our egos.
We're up to 89.
Beat
That's
our
a
egos.
Lot.
Damn, are we at 89 5-star ratings?
As of right now, yeah.
Oh. It's a hit.
See, listen to how happy it makes us.
It's a hit! Wow. And we are also, I believe next week is going to be officially 2 months of the First Risk Podcast.
Yeah, something like that.
It's going to be
Look at us.
8 weeks. Look at us. Wow, made a plan and sticking to it.
Soon enough, we'll be through with all of season one, which will be exciting.
I don't want season one to end yet. I'm really enjoying it.
But consider the fact that once it's over, we get to see, one, Eddie Diaz's beautiful face.
And two, Maddie Buckley's beautiful face.
Beautiful face.
See, there's something for both of us. It's just that the thing for me is also the thing for you, because that's your baby.
Listen, there's crossover. There's crossover.
There's crossover. And as a notorious gay boy, I, of course, stan Jennifer Love Hewitt like no other. So I'm looking forward. It's just I'm not ready to say bye to Abby yet. I'm loving Connie. I'm loving Abby. I don't know. I'm getting sad now thinking about it, because I love her. I love her.
She's definitely a great part of the show.
Here's to enjoying the always fabulous Connie Britton while we still can.
Exactly. And with that, we will send you off with an
awoo.
Mine was way more half-hearted than yours.
Yeah, you kind of phoned it in a little bit. I'm kind of embarrassed.
I'm
for
the
you.
Scott McCall of the I'm the Scott McCall of the two of us.